Adam. I mean, you look at what Powell said last week, which is that the economy is strong at the same time that the Atlanta Fed has just now lowered the second quarter GDP forecast to minus 2.1. So this will be, as you alluded to, I mean, we're basically looking right at a technical recession.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. As we head into the heat of summer, the U.S. economy finds itself in the doldrums. GDP growth for the year has been negative both in Q1 and Q2, which means we're now officially in a, quote, technical recession. Inflation remains at a 41-year high. The financial markets continue to suffer one of their worst years so far in history, and now the housing and jobs markets are also cooling fast. So, what can we expect from the second half of this year? For perspective, we turn to David Hay, co-founder and co-chief investment officer of Evergreen GovCall, a financial advisory firm managing $3.5 billion worth of investor capital. As its steward, David can't simply rely on an opinion. He has to steer this capital safely through what's coming next. So his conviction needs to be as high as possible. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome, Adam. I'm privileged to be here.
Oh, gosh. Privilege is mine, David. I'm glad we could finally make this happen. Look, lots of questions here for you. But if we can, let's just start at a very high level. What is your current opinion of today's global economy and financial markets?
Well, to use a highly technical term, I'd say it's a mess. I'd say it's a total mess. It may be the craziest combination of bad things coming together that we've ever seen. And, you know, frankly, I think we got to lay the blame at the doorstep of the Fed and the other central banks, because, frankly, I think they've been engaged for at least the last 14 years in bubblenomics. But I think you could probably argue going back even further and relying on trying to drive asset prices up. And as so often with the Fed, when they try to achieve something, they usually get more than they bargain for, and then it creates a real counter-reaction on their part to get things under control. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen this time, where they clearly wanted to create an economic slowdown, and they clearly wanted to create bear markets. And I think they're going to get what they wish for, good and hard. But getting back to the point of these bubbles, and it really has been a series of bubbles, and I don't think this gets enough press, that bubble 1.0, which was tech, you know, late 90s, bubble 2.0, housing, kind of the 05-07 period. And then since the global financial crisis, we've had this gradual buildup thanks to QEs 1, 2, 3, 4, plus what was going on overseas from the other central banks. All this just, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars from nothing, you know, just from their, what I call their magical money machines. And then you had last year, the crescendo, and really I'd call it the bubble in almost everything. And I believe, and I know others do too, that we kind of hit peak insanity in the first quarter of last year. And it was an interesting period. I don't know if you've read some of the Jay Powell minutes or pressers where he was talking about, I mean, he was being pressed really. This is when the meme stocks were going nuts in early last year, and he's being pressed by reporters. I mean, Mr. Powell, this sure seems like a bubble. And as you know, the Fed always says, well, there really are no such thing as bubbles, or you can't identify them. And he said, oh, well, really, you know, stocks aren't that high if you look at interest rates, because interest rates are very low, which, of course, the Fed totally manipulated. And then he went on to say in the same press conference a little bit later, well, actually, there's not that tight a correlation between the, you know, equity risk premium, which is another way of saying interest rates relative to stock prices. And so in one press conference, he basically contradicted himself. And to me, that's pretty disturbing. And that's a pattern that I've seen playing out with the Fed in recent years, where there's just a lack of accountability, a lack of honesty. And I think you're seeing that today, Adam. I mean, you look at what Powell said last week, which is that the economy is strong. Maybe it was the week before, because we had I think it actually was last week. Anyway, very recently, that the economy is strong, the consumer is strong, at the same time that the Atlanta Fed has just now lowered the second quarter GDP forecast to minus 2.1. So this will be, as you alluded to, I mean, we're basically looking right at a technical recession. And yet he's not saying that. He's saying the economy is just fine. And yet the New York Fed has got 80% odds of a hard landing, you know, basically a recession. So somehow he's not getting the notes from his very own people about how rapidly this economy is decelerating. I've been doing this 43 years. I don't think I've ever seen an economy lose altitude at the rate that this one is. That's probably a very long-winded answer for you.
No, but that's actually a really telling comment. And it is interesting. You mentioned the GDP, the Atlanta Fed GDP Now numbers. I looked at them over the past week and hadn't looked at them for a week or two, was surprised to see that they had upgraded it when I checked at the beginning of the week from just 0.0% growth to 0.3%. And then noted on, I think it was Thursday, that they had downgraded it from 0.3% to -1.0%. And I commented on that on Twitter and said, hey, folks, we should pay attention here. And then I checked the next day and they downgraded again from -1% to -2.1%. It's like falling in real time. So you said a lot of great things there. You said, we're seeing these reactions and counter reactions from the Fed. And I've talked about this. I'll actually put up a link to a video I put out, I think over a year ago. I'm going to pat myself on the back a little bit, sort of predicting what you're talking about here, which is how the Fed is going to sort of lurch from policy mistake to policy mistake. And as the justification for that, I cite the bullwhip effect, which I won't go into in a ton of detail here, that little video does. But one of the things that was sort of nice to see was last week, Michael Burry of The Big Short fame actually was talking about exactly this. He was talking about how the Fed was lurching from policy mistake to policy mistake, citing the bullwhip effect. And I think that's what you're talking about here too. Absolutely. You also said, given the errors that the Fed is making, the fact that it hasn't seen, it really missed a lot of what's been happening in its forecasting earlier on. You said we hardly have seen a lack of accountability and a lack of honesty like we're seeing from today's Fed. I would also throw in there sort of a lack of competence. And I'm curious if you would throw that in there too.
Well, I think by definition that you're right, because the Fed has never called one recession in advance, even when it's happened a month later, which with all the PhDs they have on staff and computer power, it's stunning.
Right. And it's thousands of PhDs, right?
Right. And when you look at not just the recessions, but also interest rate predictions, they've only gotten those right about 37% of the time, and they control interest rates. And that's pretty pathetic. I said in my book, Bubble 3.0, which we just put out earlier this year, that the Fed might think about investing in a dartboard, because I think they could really
be right more often.
They'd be right. At least they'd be right theoretically half the time. But it's just stunning. And I think the only explanation, obviously lots of bright people, but as I was mentioning earlier, I think this is a classic case where you've got certain niches of the Fed that are saying we've got a problem and telling a very different story than Jay Powell is. And I think the one of the fundamental problems of the Fed is they create a narrative within their inner sanctum, in the Eccles building of, the guys that get to sit around that big polished table. And they, if something doesn't fit the narrative, they go out of their way, just like I was saying with this whole bubble thing and Powell's complete denying that, they'll just go out of their way to try to justify what their groupthink is. And a lot of times their groupthink is wrong, because it's almost monetary policy by wishful thinking. It's this is what we want to happen. So and we're going to keep saying that until, just look at what inflation transitory, that whole thing last year, they kept saying that through the worst of the worst inflation explosion we've had in 40 years. And it took just overwhelming evidence for them to finally back away from that. So it is disturbing. And I really do put the blame for much of what has gone wrong in our country over the last 20 years at the doorstep of the Fed. It's interesting that when the tech bubble first burst, I don't know if you know this, but Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner, obviously very influential journalist with the New York Times, he was literally begging the Fed to create another bubble in the wake of the bursting of the tech bubble. And he specifically mentioned housing. And he kept hammering them, and of course they did it. They kept interest rates way too low. The economy was actually recovering pretty rapidly in 2003, 2004, and they kept interest rates at basically depression levels. And of course, the housing just went nuts. And you had Greenspan egging people on to take out adjustable rate mortgages, even though they were in the midst of a beginning of a rate hiking cycle. And we all know what happened. It was an absolute, you mentioned The Big Short earlier, and it was, that actually is what triggered me to first start writing my newsletter in 2005, which at the time was called the Evergreen Virtual Advisor, or EVA, because I just thought this was insanity building up in the housing market. And as negative as I wasn't negative enough. I mean, what occurred obviously in 2008, 2009 that was a terrifying event. And it was close to just seeing the whole, as George W. Bush said, the sucker going down. Now it didn't. And of course the Fed gets kudos to a degree for intervening. And that's when they started QE1. But one thing that I think is missed about that is that they did it very wrong. You know, they created $1 trillion. And I actually was pleading with them at the time to create something like $1 trillion rescue fund. But what I was proposing was, as you remember at that time, it was an absolute wipeout on the credit market. Stock market was down, but the credit markets were like 1932.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, junk bonds were yielding 23%. And you had AAA rated CDOs, these collateralized debt mortgage vehicles that, you know, they were structured in such a way that the AAA rated tranches had very little chance of being worth less than 90 cents on the dollar. And they were trading at 40 cents on the dollar. And banks were loaded to the gunnels with them. And you had that FASB 157, whatever it was, where they had a mark to the market, which was a relatively new rule. So virtually every financial institution in America was broke. I don't care who you were. If you had a mark to market at those AAA rated securities, you were out of business. And that's the way they were starting to trade. What the Fed should have done early on, instead of, you know, dithering for months and months and months, they should have gone in there and bought those credit instruments. And they could have done it with a very small amount of money. And the proof is, if you fast forward then 12 years to March of 2020, when COVID is raging and the credit markets are once again in free fall, the Fed steps in and says, we're going to buy corporate debt, including junk bonds. The first time ever. And that's something I had forecast a few years earlier. People made fun of me for saying that. They said, it's impossible. It's illegal for the Fed to do that. I said, don't worry. They'll figure out a way.
Yeah, they'll change the rules.
Yeah. And it was, as you may know, by the end of the year, by the end of 2020, they'd only spent $18 billion. And yet just simply the fact that they said they were going to buy corporate debt turned the market. That was the one event, because it was just a free fall before that. And they'd done all this other stuff and it wasn't working, and, you know, all their special credit facilities. But once they announced that they were going to buy corporate debt, man, it was just a V-shaped bottom. So they could have done that. They could have done that back in 2008. Instead, they took that $1 trillion that they printed up the first time they used QE, their magical money machine, and they bought the most overpriced assets on the planet, treasuries, which were yielding nothing at a time when, you know, even high quality corporate bonds were yielding 9 to 12%. And you had preferreds yielding 14, 15. Anyway, they learned their lesson. And I do think that's important because, you know, you're very aware, I mean, these credit spreads are moving out very rapidly. We're, 600 over on junk today. So that means the overall junk bond market's yielding 9. If that keeps going that direction, I think they have no choice but to do the same thing again. And if that doesn't work, I think they'll actually use, because they have about $1 trillion running off from their, you know, vast portfolio of purchased securities, all with fake money, of course. So they're going to have a ton of cash flow coming in every single month for maturing T-bills that they could use to stabilize asset prices. So they don't have to print. They could say, well, we're just doing a portfolio rebalance. They'll spin it, you know, much more benignly, because obviously inflation is, you know, it's just changed everything. They got away with all this money creation before because inflation was subdued. Obviously, that's not the case any longer.
All right. Wonderful. And you're heading right in the territory I was going to try to ask you to go into. So we're already in the thick of it. Just a reaction to a couple quick things you said. One, you said that it really feels like today that we are exercising monetary policy by wishful thinking. I went into this fairly deeply last week with economist Steve Hanke, who's a Johns Hopkins professor of economics. I'll put up a link to that video here for anyone that wants to see that too. But he shares your sentiment, David, and he really talked about it being sort of like an ideological blindness. Right, that they're just not looking at the data. They're just trying to interpret everything through the current goggles that they wear, which aren't terribly reality based. I think we're finding out here. So, really fascinating about what the Fed could have done back in 08 versus what they did do. And I'm reminded by a comment that Jim Rickards made when he was on a panel that I was moderating. And we asked a question about the Fed, and he said, actually, projecting Fed policy is the easiest part of my job. He said, I literally just sit down and think, what is the worst decision they could make here? And I pick that one, and it tends to be right. And I loved your comment there about investing in the dartboard. Actually, I think the Fed should just do QE one more time and just print up a quarter and flip that, because it seems like that'll get them from 37% to 50% pretty quickly in terms of their accuracy. Probably the best thing they could, best return on investment they could make. But okay, I feel like we're sort of halfway in already to what's all in your book. And I just want to mention the title here for folks that might want to go look at it. It's called Bubble 3.0. And you just told us where that is in the sequence of historic bubbles in this, for this new century. Who blew it and how to protect yourself when it blows apart. So I guess real quick, just setting some context here. Obviously the Fed is the main culprit in the story, at least a big culprit. Is it all the Fed? Are there any other big players here? Sure. In terms of kind of the blowing of Bubble 3.0, is there anything we haven't talked about yet that you think is important just for understanding its backstory?
Yes. In fact, that's a great lead-in. I was afraid I would forget to bring this up, but I do think the biggest policy mistake of the last 40 years was not the fault of the Fed. I think it falls to Congress and other policymakers. And that is, and I don't know, I'm really curious whether anybody else has brought this up. And you mentioned Jim Rickards, he's absolutely brilliant. Why is it that the Social Security Trust Fund really has nothing in it? I know people say, oh, well, there's trillions of dollars of government bonds in there. Oh, great. I mean, those government bonds are basically unserviceable as it is. I mean, forgetting even that portion, just the, you know, on balance sheet debt of the government. But why did they not, for over 40, when the Social Security system was running huge surpluses, and those surpluses could have been invested in a 50-50 stock bond ETF mixture, and have, I mean, it could be the largest pool of dollars on the planet, and it wasn't done. Now, I have my theory as to why they didn't do it, but it's an embarrassing theory if I'm right, which is basically that they were using those surpluses to make the deficits look better at the time. But they did that right through the time in the late 90s when the government started running such large surpluses that Alan Greenspan publicly worried that we'd have no government bond market by 2010 because we would have paid off all the debt. There was a long time there where we could have been funding, and that didn't mean that it would be like a 401k, but I mean, just a typical corporate pension plan is invested in stocks and bonds, right? Even though the benefits to their plan beneficiaries are guaranteed by the company, as long as the company stays in business. So the government would not be endangering people's Social Security, and quite the contrary, they would have been protecting it. Now we're in a position where, you know, you had Luke Grohman on here recently, great podcast. He's brilliant. I'd call him always brilliant, to use one of his favorite terms. And he was saying that there's $2.6 trillion of basically boomer entitlements that are now having to come on balance sheet. The days of kicking the can down the road are over. And that didn't have to be that way. There could have been real money there to fund those benefits, and how that didn't happen. But you tell me, have you heard anybody else bring this up?
Well, it's funny. It's like you're pitching me a big fat softball here, because I just put out a video last week I'll link up to here that doesn't go into exactly this, but it really delves deeply into the failure of society plus the government in terms of where we are today in terms of retirement savings for America's senior and the massive tsunami of boomers that are continuing to retire. So just to give you a couple of quick stats here. In terms of how poorly funded Social Security is, the average monthly payment is $1,600 a month, right? Which we all know is not a livable wage at all. In fact, the average rent payment in America is $1,900 a month. So it doesn't even cover a monthly rental expense. And at its current, the trustees just announced a report last month, and their annual report, and it says that at current trajectories, Social Security Trust is on track to be insolvent by 2035. So that's only 13 years from now. Medicare is even worse. It's on track to be insolvent by 2028. That's in 6 years. So to your part about, putting ourselves in a position nationally where these programs are just woefully underfunded, where we could have had a much different story if we had just been more prudent about how we allocated that funds. Absolutely. You know, at this point, I think it's an unavoidable national crisis. And Luke does a really good job of just basically saying, hey, you know, when you look at the current trajectory here, we are essentially going to be spending all of our tax receipts. In fact, you know, the overall cost is going to be more just to pay interest on our national debt and fund these entitlement programs. Like, they're basically going to swamp the entire budget in the not too distant future if things don't change. People are talking around the edges of the problem like this.
Right, around the edges, but I just have not heard it addressed. Like, why, you know, back in the 1980s when it started running the big surpluses, because you had so many boomers entering the workforce and entering their prime earning years. I mean, that was the time to do it. And yet there was no, I never saw anything about that. Maybe Bush Jr. had some kind of proposal, but of course it got shot down. I think that anytime people talk about putting it into something other than the government securities, it's like somehow viewed as jeopardizing it when it's actually completely the opposite. But to your point about the, you know, the rundown of these, you know, trust funds, so what's going to happen in the meantime? It means that they're going to be selling treasury bonds to pay benefits, right? And that's why it's not exhausted, is there still is, it's running a deficit, has been for several years, but there's still this big pool of treasuries in there. But to actually pay benefits with that, you got to sell them. And guess what? At the same time, you've got the Fed doing QT. And then let's just say that we really are going into recession. What's going to happen to government revenues?
Right.
And I think it's Luke Grohman, once again, who's pointed out that in May, government tax receipts fell 16%, which is a shocking number. Now, he points out there's a lot of month-to-month volatility. I actually thought it was going to be a pretty good number just because the IRS is so slow processing and they've been having a windfall, as we know. I mean, government revenues have exploded up until basically May, which kind of fits in with everything else. Like I was talking about how rapidly things have fallen off the cliff. And we hear this anecdotally from our clients too, that say, oh, my business was fine until April or May, and then it's just almost shut down. And so the point is he's well conveyed, is that once you're in a situation where your revenues are down, your expenses are going to go up because there's going to be more unemployment claims and other social support spending. You have foreign buyers that really aren't very interested in buying treasuries, especially given the sanctions. You know, there's a lot of countries that go, I don't know if I want to hold my reserves and treasuries anymore. So your buyers are shrinking. And the Fed, of course, has been the huge buyer. So it's gone from a huge buyer to a seller.
So your biggest and most cost insensitive buyer has left the building.
Exactly. That's a little terrifying. So that's why this could be a really difficult period. I mean, I do think that we could get a break with inflation, though I think there's some hot months ahead, hot numbers to come this summer. But one thing about recessions, and this happened, I'm old enough to remember the 1970s, unfortunately. And even in the inflationary 70s, when there was a recession, inflation came down hard. So I think we're going to see inflation decline. Now, this is something that is really quite a fascinating factor that I bet even you haven't heard. 17% of US consumers now expect deflation over the next few years. That's double what it was in 2008. So that's very surprising to me. It's maybe telling us that there's just this tremendous fear that the thing is going to blow apart and prices will actually fall. And of course, we're seeing that the CRB metals index is down something like 24%. You know, lumber's been crushed, even oil's, I mean, oil's still over 100, but it's come down substantially. Natural gas is down to $6 per MMBTU, which is like a gallon of gas. Interestingly, in Europe here last month, there was 1 week where gas went up $12 alone.
Yeah.
1 week in Europe, double what the total price is in the US, which just shows the terrible situation that Europe is in. And just as a little footnote, we should probably talk about energy since that's one of my strong suits and favorite areas. But JP Morgan is saying we could actually see oil go to $400 a barrel if there starts to be a major cutoff of Russian oil, which everybody seems to want, except Russia. But, you know, it's, again, be careful what you wish for. And if they cut by or sanctioned by 4 or 5 million barrels a day, I kind of doubt it'll be that severe because they're pretty clever at getting around the restrictions and the blockages.
Right.
Anyway, it's energy.
Still, I mean, you say that, let's take half that price, still, you know, kind of catastrophic to the economy. Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, look, the government is historically, but certainly these days, it's a factory of unintended consequences. you know, almost every policy that they implement seems to backfire and have almost the opposite intent here, right?
Sadly.
Yeah. So we go back to that sort of that competence element. All right. So let's see where to go with all this. So you mentioned that stat of 70% of Americans that expect deflation. That's interesting. And it actually loves to see
17%,
that.
17%.
Yeah, 17%.
17. But yeah, it is double what it was in 08, which really surprised me. That was a time where there was quite a few deflationary expectations around.
Right. Well, what's interesting, we've been actually talking on this program relatively recently that while the world is so focused on inflation, understandably, because it's in our faces right now, right? You fill up your car, you go to the grocery store. But we have been warning people that disinflation and deflation may actually be the bigger threat here to have your eye on over the next, you know, coming year or so, given all the demand destruction and the recession that you've mentioned here several times. Time will tell what'll happen, and we're probably not going to get there like next month, but it very well, we may be talking in a year from now, not about, 9% annual CPI, but we may be talking about the fact that millions of people are getting laid off, you know, in a really deep recession. So it's interesting to hear you sort of banging that same drum here. So where are we in terms of the bubble's evolution here? So you've warned about bubble 3.0. You just talked about how it got blown. Has the bursting happened? Did we see the peak back December of last year? Has it popped and we're now riding the downside of this thing?
I think unquestionably. And as I said, I think for the really speculative stocks, they actually peaked in the first to second quarter of last year, you know, right around the time that Powell was denying there was any bubble.
Right. And so, we were at the height of our monetary plus fiscal stimulus, and it just looked like endless amounts of trillions was the new normal.
Right. Right. And of course, a lot of that did flow into the stock market. A lot of the stimmy checks flowed into the, you know, the meme stocks and the cryptos. And I mean, I've got one chapter in my book that's, I call it the insanity bubble. I mean, it was in the poster child for that was, in my opinion, Dogecoin, which got up to an $88 billion market cap, which was more than some U.S. blue chips. And the founder, Billy Marcus, said, it's a joke. What are you thinking? It's not worth anything. And he kept saying that all the way up. You know, I think he started saying that when it hit $20 billion. And now, of course, it's been crushed, but it's still $8 billion or so, maybe.
It's still over $8 billion in market cap right now. Yeah, I looked at it this morning. I remember, too, someone was asking him over the past year, you know, what he was thinking. They asked him some technical question about what he was thinking when he coded it. And he said, I wasn't thinking anything. I just copied the Bitcoin code and spent maybe 45 minutes on it. I mean, literally just this total flyer, you know, lark that became at one point a almost $90 billion market cap.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about GameStop and AMC and how ridiculous they got. They were a fraction of that. And they actually have a real business, even though those real businesses consistently lose money. But anyway, this whole profitless, you know, disruptor thing that was so popular last year, I mean, that those things are down 70, 80, 90%. And I don't think they've hit bottom. I mean, I guess, you know, for some of these, there's really strong support at zero. It probably won't go negative like the futures price of oil did in April of 20. But,
right, which is so hard to wrap our brains around, you know, only 2 years ago that it traded at a negative price. And now you're talking about the potential that it could go as high as $400 a barrel. It's just.
Well, they say crazy. The cure for low prices is low prices.
Yeah, exactly. And same is true. Cure for high prices is high prices, right? They organically destroy demand because people can't afford stuff. And then, of course, the Fed is out there actively trying to add a lot of tailwind to that, right? By raising the cost of capital here. So where do you sort of see this trajectory going from here? Does it accelerate into a fast decelerating economy and straight into recession? Do you see us being spiky, swinging back and forth? What path do you think we're most likely to take from here?
Well, I think we will see recession. And this is not what I felt a few months ago. I've kind of shifted with the data. Kind of reluctantly, what I did think we were going to have virtually for sure was an earnings recession. And I think, I know you've had Stephanie Pomboy on. She's the one who really kind of opened my eyes to this idea of look at the PPI versus the CPI. So the PPI is basically what companies, their cost of goods sold, and CPI is what they get. So when the CPI is running really hot, the PPI relative to CPI is running really hot, it squeezes margins. and my gosh, I just saw that in Europe now, it's like the PPI is running at 36%. And I think that all gets back to the price of energy in Europe being so much higher. So in Wall Street, very similar to the Fed with their ridiculous 4% real GDP growth forecast for the second half, Wall Street's got a 10% earnings increase in the fourth quarter. And I think they're just nuts. I mean, I really do think we're going to have falling earnings in the second half of the year. So
I just want to underscore this because I've mentioned this a fair amount in the past week on this program, exactly what you're talking about, which is for whatever reason, analysts have been reluctant to bring down their growth projections for next year. I think the last time I heard that it was still about a 10% increase in the S&P earnings. And looking at the outlook that you're talking about, right? I mean, it's hard to make a credible case for that, right? And we're now beginning to see demand destruction. We're beginning to see companies, you know, announce earnings and say, hey, you know, we Target and Walmart were saying last quarter, hey, we stocked up and the demand didn't show up. And now we have this skyrocketing inventory. And we've got a bunch of people around that we're not being able to employ fully. And we're seeing that in a number of other industries as well. So we are about to go into Q2 earnings seasons, right? We're here at the beginning of July. We're going to start having those earnings calls, what, in about 2 weeks or so for Q2. And the few that have come out already, I'm thinking like Micron just announced this thing like a week ago, where they crushed their Q2 numbers, revenue, earnings, way above forecast, but they completely underwhelmed in terms of their forward guidance. And they said, look, we have to ratchet this stuff down based upon what we're seeing in real time at our stores right now. Stock got hammered, understandably. So is this new shoe to drop of Wall Street analysts waking up to the fact that an earnings recession can't be avoided at this point, and it's going to force them to bring down their forward earnings projections? Is that going to be the next and near-term shoe that's going to drop financial asset prices lower from here?
Well, certainly, I think stock prices are at risk. It might actually be good for the treasury market, but yes, I think that's right. And I just, they are so perennially optimistic. It's kind of like the Fed. It takes an awful lot of evidence the other way to shift them. But what you were saying about Micron is exactly what I was referring to. I mean, here they say good numbers, which actually our analysts thought they would have good numbers, but their forecast is terrible. So I think that reflects just the rapidity with which the economic cycle is turning down. I mean, that's one company, but we're seeing lots and lots of evidence. You mentioned Target and Walmart, and there are some retailers that have reported good numbers, but you know, that's tended to be the higher end. And maybe the canary in the coal mine is Restoration Hardware, which is, you know, kind of a bull market furniture stock.
And it's completely consumer discretionary.
Right. And so when the high end folks are making a lot of money and what I'd call monopoly money, kind of money from nothing and all these crazy things, then they go out and buy a lot of high end furniture. But their outlook is now very guarded as well. I just think this is happening. This decline, this deceleration is happening very, very rapidly. And it's, if you look at things like if the S&P is down 20% for more than 5 months, you get a recession. If you look at the leading economic indicators, 4 out of the last 5 months have been down, you get a recession 99% of the time going back to 1959. When you have the 4-week moving average for initial jobless claims rise 60,000, which is what's happened here recently, you get a recession. You know, all these things are all just suddenly lining up. And you know, there's the view that, hey, that's good news, because if we have recession, then the Fed's going to go on hold and then they'll start easing. But this Fed, I don't know, they're so, when they get focused on something, it takes an awful lot to get them to shift. And right now they're clearly focused on trying to control inflation. So it's going to take some awfully bad economic numbers, probably an unemployment rate that really starts to jump in a way they can't deny, that will cause them to reverse course. So I don't know whether they get to 4%. I think they're going to go higher. They're probably going to do 75 basis points this month, although it's a little less certain than it was a few weeks ago. But I mean, this is the problem, is you've got the Fed for the first time ever tightening into a bear market. You've also got them tightening into a clear slowdown, if not recession. This is pretty unprecedented. I know that's an overused word, but I think this qualifies. But I do want to get back to something you said, because you said something very important. And I think this is where there's going to be a negative surprise again, which is the cure for high prices is high prices. But first of all, if you look at the price of oil at $100 a barrel, inflation adjusted, it's not high. It's really just kind of average. So it's especially when you compare to energy prices in Europe, including coal. I mean, oil is actually a steal. And they are, by the way, burning oil in Europe to produce electricity. Of course, they're burning lots of coal too, which is unfortunate for the environment. So the problem is, you're right. When the price of oil goes up a lot, then you start to produce supply, but you're not getting that supply response. And we know why. I mean, right, ESG is one thing. You know, the Biden administration's classic in this regard. I mean, they're hammering them on one time, and basically, we're going to try to put you out of business over the next 5 to 10 years, but we want you to invest a lot of money, you know, in new wells and new refineries.
Yeah.
And naturally, oil companies are a little reluctant to do that. So that's one factor, but also for years now, because there's been two wicked oil busts in the last 8 years, these guys were already shell-shocked. So there has been tremendous capital expenditure starvation that's afflicted this industry for years and years and years. So we're now reaping that. And you probably saw this video with Biden and Macron last week, you know, where he comes up to him and says, hey, I talked to MBS, you know, Saudi Arabia, and they really don't have much spare capacity, which is what we subscribe to Mike Rothman at Cornerstone Analytics. I think he's the best on tracking the energy complex. And he's been saying this for years, that they're this myth that the Saudis have all this spare capacity just isn't true. They're running pretty much full out right now.
Yeah. And I just want to underscore the point you're making, because it's a very big sort of macro point, which is we have for, in many cases, more than a decade for a number of key commodities, oil being one of them, really starved a lot of key commodity sectors of CapEx. And so what that does is that sets you up in the future for scarcity, right, which is for higher prices. And Rick Rule has warned about this a lot. Art Berman, who's a big oil expert, has everything you've said about oil so far, David, echoes what Art's been saying here. So, you know, in some ways, we're fighting a problem that you know, was started years ago. We're making it worse with inconsistent, probably conflicting current policies, right? And you gave a great example of, hey, we want oil to be cheaper, but hey, we want you guys to, you know, not drill anymore. And I mean, it's we're basically giving the oil industry right now, whether you like it or not, an impossible and contradictory mandate. And then, of course, you have what's going on with Russia, right? So we do kind of have this perfect storm right now. I'm curious about this, and energy is the key thing. It's what the world pivots around. It's what powers the economy. It what makes our way of life possible. So it really is the key thing to look at. Lines of trade are changing materially right now. No surprise. You know, when you have an instance like this where a commodity becomes in high control, the system, the capitalist elements of the system try to take advantage of that and bring whatever production can be brought on better, faster, less efficient uses of oil can be reprioritized for more efficient uses of them. So my question here, and none of us knows for sure, but is, do you expect, despite the major macro issues we talked about, do you expect oil prices to moderate from here because of the system trying to react to this, as well as just general demand destruction begins to dampen economic demand for oil? Or do you feel like different game now?
Well, it's a great question. I just think that you got a battle between demand destruction and supply destruction.
Yeah.
And so far, we haven't seen very much demand destruction. The demand for oil tends to be pretty inelastic. So I actually think the oil market's going to get tighter as this year goes on, which is maybe a non-consensus view. But I think the shortage is going to get more and more intense as the months go by. And, you know, probably Mr. Putin is going to be behind at least some of that. But that's the way it was trending, you know, even before the invasion of Ukraine. I think there's a fallacy out there that it's because of Ukraine that we have this energy shortage. But actually, Europe's problem, we actually put out a chapter of my book early through my newsletter last October, pointing out what was happening to European energy prices even then. It was shocking. I mean, that's when oil price or natural gas prices went to basically $35 a gallon. Again, it's
right.
MMBTU. And coal prices were going nuts. They went nuts over in Asia as well. Natural gas, LNG prices in Asia have, you know, they're also kind of in that 30 range. Here we sit in America with this, you know, this almost unwanted bonanza of oil and gas that we think is so horrible. And, it's saving us, and it's saving Europe too. I mean, if it wasn't for U.S. LNG export, just, we see what happened to that Freeport thing when that went down and what that did. I think that was 12% of U.S. LNG exports to Europe, and trying to get that back online, but that's proven to be problematic. We got an energy short world is the bottom line. But right now, because, so much of the money these days is driven by computers and algos. And so the algos say, okay, recession, sell everything that's resource-based, right? I mean, it's just starting on June 8th is when all this stuff just started getting absolutely annihilated. And I think that's when recession fears really started to get discounted widely.
Yeah. And by all this stuff, are you talking about energy stocks? Or are you talking just about everything?
Everything resource related. Okay. I mean, look at copper. I mean, Freeport, the copper producer, not Freeport LNG, but Freeport, the copper producer, is down from over 50, like 52 to, I think it's 27 this morning. And the demand for copper is going to go through the roof. Right now, there's about 24 million tons consumed per year. Only about 7% of that, something like 1.5 million tons, is actually used for green applications. But as we ramp up these millions of additional EVs, the demand for copper is just going to go absolutely vertical. But nobody's looking at that right now. And if you look at oil, again, you get this incredible shortage. Don't believe me, believe the futures market. Look at the backwardation. So backwardation happens when you've got a real short supply situation. And the oil market's about as backwardated as it's ever been.
Sorry, can you just explain backwardation for the folks watching who aren't familiar with that term?
So normally it's contango, which means that the spot price is cheaper than the futures price, because there is a cost to carry even with low interest rates. But when you get into a shortage situation, the spot price goes above the futures price. And the further out you go with oil, the more there is that future discount to the spot, which I haven't looked lately, but for most of the recent months has been running about $20 over a two-year period. So if oil was 100, you could buy future oil at 80.
It seemed
like just an incredible deal, because the shortages are going to get more intense. I mean, do one other factor. Think about what's happening with the SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And I'm sure this isn't for political reasons that we've been releasing, obviously tongue in cheek, releasing hundreds of millions of barrels out of that Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And it's getting down to the point where there's not a whole lot left. I mean, it's going to be really at rock bottom by the time the midterm elections roll around. That's got to be replenished. So that's future demand that's going to come back our way. The other thing is China's reopening. And they actually had a drop in demand because of the lockdowns. And so that demand is going to accelerate. So I look at these commodities that are so hammered. I mean, they had been great performers up until, like I said, about June 8th, but they've been absolutely annihilated. And there's one energy producer that's gone from, it was 120 last month. It's now at 64. So it's been virtually cut in half. And it's projected to earn roughly $28 a share this year. And get this, $46 next year. So again, it's selling at $64 a share, projected earn $46 next year. Unbelievable.
All right. So I got to ask, do you mind sharing the name of that commodity producer?
Sure. It's Laredo Petroleum, LPI. In full disclosure, Evergreen clients own it. And we have traded it because it has been all over the board over the few months that we've owned it. But at this point, and it's not just that one. There's, Apache and even some of the big blue chips like Shell and Total. I mean, I think in this environment, one of my consistent recommendations in our Making Hay Monday, which is our more of our action item newsletter, is go carefully, go slowly. Don't get fully invested by any means. And it doesn't matter how cheap something looks, it can get cheaper. But I do think if somebody is disciplined and dollar cost average on a methodical basis through all this turmoil, you're going to come out at the other end really good. Because at some point, if the Fed says, okay, we're done, you know what's going to happen. The market's going to go absolutely nuts. And if they're doing that in conjunction with something like supporting the credit markets, it could be an extremely powerful rally. But I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, to be honest.
Okay, worse before it gets better. So I want to get to your outlook for the markets and what asset classes you like, which ones you'd really stay away from. You're giving us a sneak peek already on the resource side of things. But real quick, let's just finish out sort of the macro outlook part of it. So first off, in terms of the recessionary era that we're going into, curious if you have any thoughts about sort of how painful and how long it could last. And if kind of reading the tone of what you're saying, correct me if any of this is wrong, it sounds like you're sort of saying, hey, we're decelerating quickly. We're on the fast track to recession here. But the CPI is not going to come down nearly as fast as economic growth is decelerating here. And that basically means stagflation, right? So is this going to be a stagflationary recession, or is it going to have like different phases? Is it going to be initially a stagflationary recession, but then we're going to start seeing disinflation and the economy is still going to be slow? So it goes from feeling like stagflation to feeling just more like a, you know, regular garden style deflation recession here. What do you think?
Yes, I think what you said is right. I think it's that, you know, that second scenario where just kind of the trend in wages, the trend in owner's equivalent rent, those things. And also you had a kind of a low base effect last summer because of weakness in energy prices for a while. That's why I think the CPI numbers are going to stay hot here for a bit. But I do think later in the year, you are going to see that disinflation that you talked about. And I think you could see inflation down to 3-4%. I don't think it's going to get to the beloved 2% that the Fed wants. I just think there's enough underlying inflationary pressures that are going to, structural inflationary pressures that will prevent a return to 2%. I think it's going to be more like the 70s where inflation came down hard, but not never really got under control. And then it takes off again in the next upcycle, which is what I think we're going to see. So I think I believe by the end of the decade, we're going to see an average inflation rate of somewhere around 5% a year. And frankly, that's what the federal government needs. And as Luke Grumman's always saying, I think he's spot on, they want to have a fairly high level of inflation, but, you know, arguing against it all the time, you know, say, oh, we're on this one, we'll get under control eventually. But a high level of nominal GDP relative to interest rates, and that's how they can deleverage. That's how they did it after World War II. World War II, the debt to GDP for the federal government got to about 110%. They had it down to 70%, maybe a little below that by the end of the Korean War, 1952. So I think that's the plan that they're following, because as we know, the U.S. federal government has the world's reserve currency. It can always create more dollars to service its debt. And the only way it can really default, which it has to do, I mean, there's just no way we can cover all these liabilities. You know, we talked about these entitlements that are now, they've been kicked down, the can's been kicked so long, but now use another analogy, chickens that are coming home to roost. So they really don't have any choice. And I think that's why you need to, as an investor, take advantage of these periodic panics with resource-based securities. They're clearly in an uptrend, but this has been one heck of a correction. And that happened in the 70s too. I do think energy is the one that is the most attractive because of this chronic shortage situation. And plus the fact, in many cases, you get great yields. So when you talk about, you know, where would I go? I would go to things like the midstream pipelines that have also been hit hard that yield around 8%. And a lot of people don't know this, but these guys get their rate increases at the PPI. And most of their expenses go at the CPI. So they're, instead of getting a margin squeeze, they're getting a margin boost.
Expansion, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a niche that most people have been so badly burned with midstream pipelines and so forth, they just don't want to go near them. And that always is appealing to me. But I also think there's real opportunities with a lot of the double B, kind of split rated, which means triple B minus is the bottom of investment grade. And double B is basically the top, double B plus of slightly below investment grade. We like that area because they rarely default. They only have about a 1% default rate historically. A lot of times they'll get upgraded to investment grade. And my goodness, you can get 6, 7, 8, even 9%. You know, a name that we like that I just wrote up is the U.S. Steel. Which has greatly improved its balance sheet. They used to have underfunded liability, pension liability. Now they're overfunded, and they're basically going to be debt-free by the end of this year, net debt, because they have so much cash. And the bonds due in 2028 or 29, it's late 20s anyway, are yielding 9.5%.
Wow. Okay.
The reality is people are terrified to buy anything cyclical, and there's nothing more cyclical than steel. So that's why you're getting, frankly, I think, a steal on U.S. steel bonds.
Yeah, a nice little pun there. Well, and that's, you know, one of the things that that obviously stock market corrections, it's part of a natural boom bust cycle, right? The market cycle, which, correct me if you disagree with this, but I think many people think the Fed has been trying to put an end to that, right? It's sort of trying to replace the market cycle with a credit cycle. There's a reason why cycles exist. They exist in nature, right? They're healthy. When you have boom times, you get malinvestment, you get projects that shouldn't be pursued, and all that stuff gets cleared out in the bust. And then your stronger companies lead the next recovery, right? So, you know, the opportunity that lies in a recession is the ability to get great companies at great values, right? And I would assume you would say, from what you said, go slow and don't rush, you know, like, hey, we're early in the game here. You shouldn't be, this isn't the time to push all your chips into the table, but you should start watching. You should come up with your shopping list, maybe start dollar cost averaging into ones that already seem pretty cheap, but really have your dry capital, your dry powder built up so that when we get further enough into this, where a lot of the correction is already played out, these companies are bottoming, and you know, we can start talking about the next upcycle. You've got that to deploy while these companies are still cheap, and you can really ride the most of that upcycle. I see you nodding as I'm saying all this.
Absolutely makes sense. It sounds good in theory, but it's so hard for people to do it.
Our interview with David will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And last, if the challenging macro outlook that David has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that David has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next over in part two of our interview with David Hay.